Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Josh Brown, I'm glad you're here.
Oh, thanks.
I just had to tap into the subconscious, say the first thing that came to mind. I'm glad he's sitting here.
I'm really disarmed by that. That's bloody lovely. I'm glad you're here. I'm really looking forward to today, Scott.
It's a nice time to do a podcast in person. And me and Josh Brown are always in the office. Jules Gill, sadly, away. He's got some electric problems in his house. Man can't guarantee a solid current to the building. Look, so, yeah.
First it's gas problems, now it's electric problems. What's it going to be next week, Scott?
He's writing a full album at this point. Gas problems, electric problems. It's the first single. But yes, this is the Entitled Banter podcast, the UBP, the UBP, the UBP, you might say.
The UBP, the UBP, the UBP.
Yeah! So I'm Scott Tilford. That's Josh Brown for this week, and maybe weeks in the future, we'll see, where we always take on whatever questions, whatever talking points you guys have. People send them over on Twitter, on Instagram. Although it was just Twitter for this week, and I thought we'd get through as many as we can. Some brilliant questions this week. Lovely little tasty crop. So, yeah, we'll get through as many as we can. First one from the 61st Gunner of 2023, who says, "Aloha, you be peeps. We all know what features absolutely ruin a video game. Microtransactions, poor writing, lack of content, over-reliance on gimmicks. But what features automatically make a game a must-play?"
Oh, what a question. What a question, Scott Telford. Do you want to take this one first?
I do. I miss physics and deformation in games. So I think if you're showing me something that lets me throw a body through a window, throw a man into a wall, some sort of ragdoll physics thing where I can kick someone in the head and then watch them pirouette over to the side, preferably through a table.
Yeah.
I'm immediately there. That's what the dream was for something like Sifu. Those animations are more canned or hand-drawn. They're not physics-y necessarily. But I love Melee stuff, and I love physics deformation in games. Nice. And I love Max Payne 2 when they brought that stuff in. And you can riddle a dude with some bullets, and then they fly against all the parts of the environment.
Oh.
All those chairs are broken.
Everyone loves Max Payne 2. I love, yeah. Any so kind of destruction within the level, just, oh, I love, man. Like, Max Payne 3, for me, funnily enough, when they kind of go even more nuts on that element where you're in firefights and if you're missing a shot, you know, you're smashing the windows behind you. For as much crap as Call of Duty Vanguard gets,
right,
I think one great element that game added to the multiplayer suite was the kind of minute destructibility of the levels. So instead of just kind of like, you know, being able to shoot panes of glass, by the end of a round of team deathmatch within that multiplayer, like, bullet holes were riddling the walls, like the walls themselves were like crashing in. There was like debris everywhere. It wasn't Battlefield levels, but it just felt like you had an impact on the level itself. I love that when it doesn't feel static.
I tell you what I was thinking of, you know, in Metal Gear Solid 3 when they first started showing it off, and there's a bit where Naked Snake is shooting up through some planks of wood. He's like he's in some water, and there's like a pier, and he's looking up through the like a dock, and there's a guard on top of the dock, and he shoots up through the wood to shoot the guy. I feel like shooting through stuff was a thing for a little while. Like
it
you
was.
Said, Max Payne 3 had it, and they would tout it in the run-up to the release of the game. Like, oh, look, we've like considered the thickness of everything in the world now. But then we sort of just moved away from that. You can still do it a little bit in the Call of Duties, like you said, and in Modern Warfare and stuff, but it's not, you don't necessarily know what you're safe shooting through. It's just that sometimes you can pepper a dude through a door or something.
Yeah, I remember, like you said there, you know, in the era of the original Ghost Recon Advanced Warfighter, it was such a big thing that you could shoot through certain objects within in the environment, certain environments themselves, certain walls, fences or whatever, and that was carried over to COD 4, and now it kind of just is a thing that's in games, but that absolutely ruled. One thing that I like to see in any game, and this is not even necessarily a feature, just something I've found recently that I'm obsessed with. And it's weird, right? Because in real life, I'm not a gunsman. I'm not a huge fan of guns. I've never handled a gun myself. But in the virtual world, I love a good hunting rifle in a game.
Like a bolt action,
a bolt
single shot.
Action, single shot hunting rifle, whether it's Fallout 3 or specifically The Last of Us Part 2.
Right.
There's something I love about controlling a character, particularly in a post-apocalyptic wasteland, in having that bolt action rifle in my hand. There's something about the tension of that you only having like one shot at a time. There's something about the tactility of reloading it after every shot and the kind of, you know, like the jerky movement that you get, which is made better in VR, by the way.
I was waiting for you to say VR mode. I thought that'd be your thing.
Yeah, it's like the weirdest fetish that I have that I realized because I just, there's something about it that I love, like that image of being facing off against zombies and you're having this kind of like rickety old weapon by your side. So any game that does that, I will give a chance.
I tell you what, speaking of clattering weapons, you remember the, I think it was the Thompson rifle in Medal of Honor? And I'm going back a bit, but in that one, that had the weird like you pull this whole bit of it back to reload it, but it would clatter loads when you were firing it. I always love weapons that feel like they're barely holding together. It's quite, I love like steampunk stuff. The thing is like that whole bolt action appeal, I do like that to a degree, but if there's a whole horde bearing down on me, I can't reload fast enough, it's just annoying. I just want something that's gonna sort of go and I can just take everybody out instead.
Yeah.
So like I do love a good, maybe like a minigun, something that's sort of gonna vaporize a lot of the populace.
We're the exact opposite, Scott Silver, and this is very funny because I like the opposite of a minigun. When I'm playing a game, if it's a shooting game, I like to use pistols more than I like to use machine guns.
Done a confused face in your direction though.
There's something I just find very satisfying about it. I think it's because I grew up with like maybe like a lot of spy movies where people were like, you know, sneaking around areas with pistols, taking out guys like that. It's why I like Max Payne 3 so much, because in that game I use the pistols and the shotguns all the time.
I tell you what,
it's all about guns, but that's kind of what I want, because there's something about those weapons I think that translates very well to
I would back that. I think for twin pistols that gets me back in. It's just the fire rate. It's literally just fire rate, so I tend to go like higher fire rate the better. There are some, there's like the P90 in like Solid Snake uses it in Metal Gear Solid 2, but you can get P90s in like Call of Duty and stuff, and they have such an insanely fast fire rate that most games end up turning down just how much damage they do. But that speed of bullet is what I want. I want something to just sort of like just go just constantly. I just want to destroy the, I also like doing the noise, so it's going to be like that. So I think that's a fun way to go.
Hey, before we move on, can I throw in one more? Just very, very quickly. Yeah. One feature that always attracts me to a game where I think you're all right, is when a game has a limited HUD, like Dead Space, even the Callisto Protocol. For as much as I didn't jive with that game, the HUDless display looked bloody gorgeous.
That compared to in Metroid Prime Remastered, it's one of those games like what was the Star Wars Republic Commando game?
Yeah.
And it's like the idea of like putting the helmet on screen. Remember when they did that in Halo and everyone was like, for the love of God, take it off.
I was one of those people.
Yeah, and it's like, it's an option to turn that stuff off, and you can in Metroid Prime as well. Playing Prime Remastered without the HUD at all is beautiful. Obviously, you get a bit lost because you do need the map and stuff. But yeah, I like the idea of games that try and artistically remove the HUD. Like Dead Space is like one of the only real examples of translating a health system to just something that's on your character.
Yes.
I feel like that should just be a mainstay in gaming. How are we still so HUD-filled? And then, you know, you see so many UIs that are just full of stuff.
That's it. There's nothing that puts me off modern AAA games more than having like a screen full of UI prompts, even if they are helpful. I don't want to see, you know, my health down one side, a massive map down the other side, an objective marker in the top right, you know, a bunch of challenges that are being tracked in the top left, and then a bunch of markers within my field of vision itself. There's something about that messiness that like really puts me off. I think I've realized over the past few years that what I love about games, the games that I love, are often like minimalist. You know, something like Sifu was so great because coming off Horizon Zero Dawn, which is full of that kind of visual noise almost, it was just straightforward, it was streamlined, and it was kind of to the point. I think in my old age, I'm looking for that streamlined aesthetic more and more.
The ripe old age of the late 20s.
Yeah.
He's getting on over there. Next question from Alpha Oliver, who says, Battlefield, Call of Duty, and Halo all released simultaneously, and we all remember how well that went. Do you think something similar will happen to Tekken 8, Street Fighter 6, and the next Mortal Kombat? If it does, what games will F up?
Ooh, you know what? You're not going to like this, I don't think. I think for me, it might be Mortal Kombat. I don't even think it will. I think they all are probably going to be quite strong. You know, I have no reason really to doubt Mortal Kombat because the last few games have been exceptional. The last one in particular, I absolutely loved. But if there's one that might fall short, I think it might be that game, just because it's had such a weird turnaround. You know, it was formally announced the other day in an investor call.
Yeah.
You know, Ed Boon and the team have been like kind kind of weirdly quiet about it. They haven't made injustice between this and the last game. It's their kind of the first time they've done a straight sequel without a game in between since like 2011 or something.
Yeah.
And I just hope that it's not a mandate from WB saying, we need one of these. You know what I mean? Don't it do anything like else. That. We need one of these.
The thing is, like, Ed Boon, like, he's been quiet about MK12 for the most part, other than, like you said, the earnings call, but he on Twitter is asking people, do you guys want a Shaolin Monks remake? Do you guys want a remake of the original trilogy? It's like, oh, it's sad that we didn't get to put this out. And it's like, okay, you must have way less control over what you can do in this space than we think you do as the creator of, or one of the creators of Mortal Kombat. And that's just kind of sad. Like, some, like, people would love a remake of Shaolin, or just the idea of remake, just put Shaolin Monks on a new console or something.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. And it's like, you know, it's the whole thing of like it being Mortal Kombat's 35th anniversary, or I think it's coming up to that. I should know exactly when that is, and I don't. But I know
think
that
it was last year, where it was maybe the 30th anniversary last year.
Yeah, there was like a logo doing the rounds, and it's just like, there was a whole thing about it being this big anniversary, and the general idea was they didn't really do much for that. And so, like, you know, there's way more things you could do with that. For me, if I'm thinking about reliability of those releases, I think of the publishers. Tekken with Namco is a, like, Namco aren't going to mess up Tekken or allow that to go sideways. Street Fighter 6 is already unbelievable. Thankfully, I've already played that, like, last year. Me and Jules played it at EGX. And it's like, that just looks gorgeous. It plays as well as it looks.
Yeah.
MK is the one where they have already a really naff publisher. Warner Brothers cannot make a straight decision to save their lives.
No.
They seem to backtrack on everything every other month. And so we already had an MK11, all the microtransaction fatality stuff, which you would hope they've learned from. But they also need MK to make a lot more bank if there was half a project that was scrapped to get back to MK12 anyway.
This is me playing purely devil's advocate because I don't envision Mortal Kombat 12 completely tanking or anything like that. It's just, if I was putting them all side by side and looking at which one I think might fall short, it's MK, because I think that franchise might get complacent because the previous entries have done so well that they might just deliver more of the same. And that might be good, but it might not be as vibrant as Mortal Kombat 11 felt, whereas Tekken and Street Fighter, while Tekken 7 was a huge thing, it was a long time ago now. I think two franchises in particular have a little bit more to prove and might be trying a little bit harder to deliver something a little bit new.
In classic us fashion, I think I'm on the opposite side, because to me, Tekken 7 had that massive long tail of season pass DLC, all the different characters they added. And Namco themselves, Katsuhiro Harada, just saying, you know, we didn't expect it to be this big, to last this long, and that we'd be able to do all these DLC packs for so long. And then in MK's, because I think for Tekken 8, it's just kind of more of that. Like, the gameplay they've put out just looks like more Tekken, which is great. It looks gorgeous. I feel like the thing that people are talking about is how much they're remixing the characters, like the new designs for Nina and Paul and everything. And then MK, like the end of MK11 was Raiden giving his power to Liu Kang to remake the whole universe, which I thought, like, almost metatextually was Ed Boon saying, like, we're going to change everything, because, like, back in, like, 2007, 2008, they wanted to completely overhaul everything anyway. And then they went through all that turmoil where their studio shut down, they got resurrected by WB, then they rebooted everything in 2011. I feel like they've wanted to do like a whole new cast of characters for a while,
right?
Or a whole new cast of powers and everything. And I feel like that's what maybe what MK12 was going to be, with like Liu Kang as the next Elder God or something, and then try and bring in some legacy characters, but it would have this new feeling. And then because it's like that, all the turmoil happened where they needed to bank on this, it can't be that anymore. So I feel like it'll be this weird hodgepodge where they'll try things in a certain direction and they'll still try and stay true to what they originally planned if they did. But at the same time, it'll be the WB side going like, but just make a Mortal Kombat game. Just make the safe thing.
Just
put Baraka in it. Just put, you know, make it work.
I think at the very least, they're all going to be very interesting. I only say what I say about Tekken 7 because while I fully agree that from a gameplay perspective, it does kind of like look like a natural progression, more of the same.
Yes.
From a technological perspective, it seems so much more than Tekken 7 ever was, like from a graphical standpoint at the very least.
It feels
next gen in a way that Tekken 7 just wasn't. And that's kind of what I mean by trying that a little bit harder. Like the base will probably be the same, but I think if you look at Street Fighter 6, which is doing some like incredible things with its engine, you look at Mortal Kombat, even 11, which has like some of the best fighting game visuals ever, a great fighting game feel. I think from Tekken's perspective, while they've got the characters and they've got the gameplay nailed down, I think they need it to feel next gen. And I think from the very very first trailer, we've seen them striving for that with that great, you know, vista of the storm raging in the background. Thing. And even every gameplay trailer we've seen since, like the Jin reveal or the Nina reveal, has looked stunning.
Yeah, man, totally. Well, yeah, the new Kazuya, well, it's not that new, but from last week, Kazuya footage where he's fighting in Times Square just looks gorgeous as well. I feel like the mechanics will be solid, and if something goes sideways, it'll be the wider machinations, it'll be the publisher machinations. Like I said, Namco and Capcom have seemed like they have genuine pride in those IPs in a way that Warner Brothers does not in Mortal Kombat. So we'll see how that stuff goes. Next question from Caleb J. Ross, who says, love you legendary legends. Have you ever considered writing a book? If you were to write a book about a video game or a video game topic, what would it be?
Thank you. We do not deserve the title of legends, I don't think. No. I appreciate it nonetheless. Scott Tilvin.
Legendarily long-form blabber. I've got long-form
some
blabber.
Indulgent answers for this, but yes. I'd like to hear if you have ever thought about this first, please, because I feel like you're a man who could absolutely write a book that I would read and love.
Thank you. Yeah, we had a thing, so long ago, we had an author write for us. I'm going back like 6-7 years. And one of their ideas was to do something on Amazon about like the 100 games to play before you die, which obviously there are tons of them now.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'd like to do my version of that, but that's a more stock thing. I think I would do the history of the games press, like the idea of where it came from, the early ideas of what the ratio was between editorial and authority and independence versus the games coverage, the journalism side of it, just being a wing of marketing.
Yeah.
And the approaches from both sides, the approaches from the people who just wanted to write and love video games and critique them and maybe help like raise the bar overall by critiquing them in a good faith way, and the business side of it, where it's like, we're going to give you access to this game early and we want you to say this. We're going to give you access to this level because it's finished and the rest of the game's on fire, and that'll hopefully get more sales and go down that way. That's just an assumptive mentality. I'm not saying that like ever concretely happened.
Yeah.
Obviously there are NDAs that people sign and stuff, but I would love to do that. I'd love to do the history of it, the sort of the different sizes of press packages that used to happen, where like people would get flown in like the early 2000s, people would get flown to like racetracks for Forza, or everyone got flew out to Miami to see Scarface, or like things like that, like really big over the top stuff. That occasionally still happens, more for the streamers and stuff, but also that side of it, the change of like the magazine press to the online press, the dawn of the internet, the dawn of YouTube, the dawn of like personalities coming to the forefront, and how that literally overhauled everything in regards to how you even think of someone like an IGN or us, like coming to us for the podcast. And I would do that. I would do something like the history of the authoritative word in gaming coverage.
I love that. I would read that. Write that book so I can read it. I'll pre-order it right now. I love that. I think like, you know, like every sort of 20-something man with a, you know, writing job, at times I've been deluded in thinking I could probably write the next best American novel. You know what I mean? The next bestseller. But I never will. I always think about writing fiction, but I'm not very good at it.
Okay.
I have like a document at home where I've written down like a bunch of details and observations about like characters and like moments and little specific kind of things that I want to flesh out at some point, but I never will because it's a lot of work and I don't have the patience for it. I'm not good enough to write it. But
give yourself enough time and you definitely do have the ability to do it.
I think it wouldn't be about like games or wouldn't be like a big story or anything. I used to be obsessed with the idea of pre-drinks and house parties because when I was younger, so much of my like development as a kid into an adult came
again,
from
Josh Brown in his late 20s.
Came from house parties and came from like pre-drinks. And I remember so much drama between friends and so much quote-unquote character development, for lack of a better term, happened in those kind of like between spaces before nights out.
Yep.
And I always have a real fondness for that because so much of my socializing came from that part of it. Mm-hmm. You know, since I was like, I was too young at like 15 into my 20s. And I always thought it'd be interesting to chart someone's life in those spaces and only catch up to them when those characters might catch up to each other if they're like drinking buddies or whatever, and catch up between pre-drink sessions or house party sessions, and you fill in the blanks between them. I don't know. I thought that was...
No, I love that. I think I always preferred the pre-drink to the night out itself because you have the best times with your friends when you're pre-drinking because you can actually have conversations. You put some favorite songs on that you have.
Exactly.
And like there's way more hashtag banter to those moments, those few hours or whatever before you head out. Everyone gets absolutely blitz drunk and you can't talk to each other when the music's too loud.
No. sure.
So that's like that stage of the night out. There's also, I think there's a lot of romance to the pre-drink stuff because maybe there's someone there that you actually want to get a bit closer to or something.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, they're feeling the same way. Okay, they're going to be there for like 20 minutes, then they've got to go somewhere else. Let me try and talk to them for a little bit.
That's it. Have you ever had like the disappointment, especially when you get a little bit older, of someone you haven't seen in a long time and you've invited them on the night out and it might be the first night out you've had in a while and they might arrive late to the pre-drinks and you're just kind of a little bit gutted because you know your time with them has been cut short and you're only going to get a few hours now before
like
you
I planned
end about.
This.
Yeah, no, yeah. And it's like, oh, we won't get this chance again for a while. There's something magic about that that I quite like. I do have another one that's way more funnier, I think, in my opinion, because I've joked about this with Adam Nicholas, right? Because me and him are big Walking Dead fans,
you
right?
You are the two remaining Walking Dead fans.
I don't even think the show's that good. Like, it has really good periods, but I'm endlessly fascinated with it. And I want to write a non-fiction book about the entire development of The Walking Dead, because that show is amazing to me because it's one of the only big shows around that like was sabotaged at every single stage by the people who made it. You know, like its network AMC just seemed to be meddling in that show all the way throughout its run. Mm-hmm. And I'm fascinated by the idea of this thing that had so much potential being kind of squandered from a storytelling perspective and like what happened with cast disputes, what happened with the original showrunner, how is this show the way it is ultimately? I think there's a good story there, but that's the one where I genuinely am joking about it, but I'm like, I would like to do that one
you
day.
Should.
I mean, I could. I've got so much stupid knowledge about that show and what's going on behind the scenes in my head that
well, I remember
I
like
get
all
it now.
With The Walking Dead back when I was a fan, the first sort of four seasons I was watching, and then the season two was like that first major blow to like, this doesn't feel right, and then reading about the writers strike and how everything got delayed, and that's like less of like a straight up like production issue that could have been solved like faster.
Yeah.
But I remember that sort of being something where it was like, oh, this isn't as tightly knit as I thought it was, and then season two being ostensibly just like a waiting game until things kind of resumed in three, and then now we're like in what, season 25 or
well
something?
It was like a bunch of spin-offs. Yeah, I just think it's like it's kind of like a microcosm of how like the world works as a whole and how all creative mediums aren't run the way you think it is. Like AMC has a huge hit with The Walking Dead season one. Mm-hmm. And you would think naturally that means amazing. We want to sustain this as much as possible. We want to support the creators. But instead they're thinking, well, we've got this huge hit. What if we slashed the budget more or less in half, doubled the episodes, and made more profit, and the writers have to deal with it? That kind of like capitalistic sense of, we don't care about the show.
No.
We just know it's a hit, and how do we extract as much money from it as possible?
Literally.
I think that's like reflective of wider industry, and I just think it's a good example of that stuff.
I feel like if a sort of like that capitalistic mindset could have a plate in front of them, a full plate, and smash it and sell you 10 separate plates, but it's just the shards. I go, no, it's still a plate. And it's like, well, no, it's not, because it's not full. I can't use it for it. It's not satisfying to use. And then they would just class it as the same thing. And what would be your video game topic if you did a video game book topic thing?
Oh, I don't know, man. Like, the video game thing is hard because unlike the other kind of spaces that I've talked about, I don't, like, I already know so many great video game writers or video game video essayists that I think it would be harder to kind of get a little sort of, like, niche within that. I'd like to do something about licensed games and just how some of those were put together. Like, I'd like to go behind the scenes of how Beenox's Spider-Man games were put into production and how little time they had, kind of similar to the Walking Dead thing, I suppose. How the Sopranos Road to Respect game was made. That's the kind of stuff that
he finds a way.
he finds a way to talk about it. Stuff like that, where I think, you know, these are games that were kind of farted out by their publisher and didn't get much respect and then were kind of forgotten about by a lot of fans, or at least the mainstream kind of like press in terms of talking about them and their development and stuff. You know, no one's talking about the creation of the Amazing Spider-Man video game tie-in as they are about the creation of God of War Ragnarok. And it's like, I bet that story is a little bit more interesting. Some weird stuff went down.
It's definitely why I love, I feel like I shout him out nearly every other week, but there's a channel called Matt McMuscles, used to be one of the two Best Friends Play, Best Friends Play, who does a series called What Happened about games like that, that are almost like forgotten to history kind of thing. I think that there's a whole wing of gaming coverage that should be devoted to that stuff, the legacy stuff, because back then it was way less exposure to the way games were made, the techniques were way more interesting. At the minute, I'm still watching through that Double Fine Psycho Odyssey, The Making of Psychonauts 2, and things like that, where they talk about, like, you know, having to figure out ways to code the physics, how to code the jump, how to code parts of the world geometry. And I remember that whole thing, I think it's in Fallout 3, when someone hacked the game's code on PC and realized that the trains are just people.
Yeah.
They're just people with train heads, and they run around on tracks, but obviously to the player, you can't see it. And I love that stuff. I love that whole, how did they make this work? And I feel like that whole thing about gaming history, there was like an era of like the rock star auteur dev, like the Hideo Kojima's, the dude that did Die Katana, who's John Romero. There are all those dudes, and that idea of like circling around, okay, this guy knows everything, this guy's gonna lead us, and they are following them almost to their doom in almost every respect. I think that's like a fascinating thing.
There's a great book out there that any TV fan should read called Difficult Men, and it's about like the asshole showrunners of great shows like, you know, like The Sopranos or The Wire or The Shield or whatever.
Mm.
And it essentially goes into like the writer's room, the production of those shows, and how like these dudes were essentially held up by the networks as like these geniuses who can't be touched. But then that led to like their absolutely temperamental attitudes, oftentimes incredibly problematic attitudes in like the writer's rooms and stuff. And it's just kind of fascinating to me how like these big productions are essentially run sometimes by just like the most chaotic people, like most nightmare people.
Like that Fantastic Four thing that just imploded.
Yeah, 100%. And it's like that. Those kind of stories are always fascinating to me.
Yeah. No, I love the double-edged sword of the creative mind. Like the idea that you do need something that makes you stand out. And that is the thing that we're going to tap back into. But is there ways to refine that and make it into, like, you know, can you sort of like focus that vision and actually make it, translate it to a whole team so they can put something together?
Yeah.
But does that remove what the creative vision would have been? Because then it's not entirely yours. That whole phrase about, like a camel is a horse put together by committee or designed by committee.
Mm-hmm.
Like you set out to make a horse and you ended up with a camel. It's like, look at these different things that changed over time. Next question from Jack Jingle, who says, most satisfying game noise or sound? I'm partial to the swish sound when you use a jump on or off a ladder in Final Fantasy VII, or the event cleared music from Tombi.
Ooh.
Those are such deep cuts. I know what that Final Fantasy VII ladder noise is.
I know what the Final Fantasy VII ladder is. Yes. I don't know what Tombi is.
Oh my God. Okay, Tombi's something I've not played in about 25 years.
Nice.
But that was on the PS1. That was like, at the time, it's just a platformer, side-scrolling platformer. But it had this really cool character called Tombi with like big pink hair, and you were like a little cave child. And you were running around jumping on pigs, and it just looked gorgeous for the time. It was like the style of animation. A little bit like Donkey Kong Country. Everything was kind of like rounded and 3D. And for 1998 or whatever it was like, nothing's ever looked this good. So that was what Tombi was. Tomba, I think, in different countries, and we had it as Tombi. One of the two. I don't remember the event cleared music. I think for satisfying game noises, I like, for like, Final Fantasy is an absolute gold mine for them. I love all the little clinks that you get when you pick up coins. There's a lot like the gill noise when your XP is ticking up. Nice. I love, specifically speaking of coin noises, when your level score maxes out at the end of a Sonic level. And it does like, it goes like, chicka-ching, and it's like, it just like banks it. It's like, whatever I just got, I just banked it. And I love that noise so much.
That's amazing, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I need to play more Sonic, I think. I really, really need you. I want these memories in my own head.
It's so good.
I've got one for you, though, that I think you might agree with. I love almost all the sounds in Metal Gear Solid 1 and 2.
Oh.
But I particularly love the menu sounds when you're either starting a game or going into the options. And I love when you press L2 or R2 to get up your inventory and like scrolling through that. The little noises that are made there, I think are amazing.
I've got another one. I'm playing through Devil May Cry at the minute because I'm having the Linkin Park phase after their single came out a couple of weeks ago. That unreleased Lost song made me go back and listen to all of Linkin Park, which I haven't done in a long time. And I used to play Devil May Cry 1 with Hybrid Theory in the background. So I started doing that again.
Nice.
Devil May Cry has all sorts of great noises that don't make any sense, where you're just in the menu and it just goes like hong, and it's just like you'll go in and out of different menus. And it's just, I don't know what that is. And sometimes it's like a clang, and then sometimes it's a hong, and I can't get enough of that. So I don't know. Yeah, there's like, loads of those weird little noises. Onimusha had quite a few of them as well. Kind of that era Capcom would put a lot of character into their menus.
Yeah.
And I think they were going for like a whole gothic architecture thing, especially in DMC3. There's a lot of just whispering happening in the menus.
Yeah.
And so there's that. But it's menu noises seem to be our thing.
Menu noises always incredible. Mm. A good menu, man, goes a long way, I think. You can tell a good game by a good menu, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned. I want to throw in one more.
Do it.
The Call of Duty hit marker noise when you're playing multiplayer.
Interesting.
And you get a hit on an enemy, and you kind of get a little bit of feedback. Genuinely, I think that tiny bit of feedback is what separates Call of Duty's gunplay from a lot of competitors. Yeah. It just feels so satisfying to get a hit, and then when you get, like, the actual noise of killing an enemy, like, it just gives you that kind of, like, Pavlovian response in your brain that you're doing something good. Just that kind of, like, small tweak.
Yeah.
A lot of games kind of copied Call of Duty and started putting hit markers when you started getting, like, you know, hits on your enemies. But that wasn't enough. You needed the sound. You needed a little bit of vibration.
It's that weird little... It's almost like a stack of papers being shuffled. Like a little sort of, like yeah. It's like that noise is. Because I remember noticing that. Because it's in, like you said, Pavlovian responses in Overwatch. Like, obviously, they had that in 2016.
Yeah.
Where you pop it as a little red skull pops up and you get the little flip, flip, flip noise as well.
Yeah.
And just being like, this just feels great to shoot the things in this game. As opposed to everything previous was just a cursor that you were hovering over people.
Yes.
But, like, yeah, the more feedback you can do in the center of the screen, I feel like there's something there that you can do a lot more with. Question from Schmantz Schmilliamson, who says, is HBO's The Last of Us overrated?
Oh.
I think it sticks out because most stories in entertainment are bad or poorly executed. It's definitely good, but I'd be more impressed if they could coherently adapt Kingdom Hearts or something. 9 episodes is too short and there's not enough Joel/Ellie. It's just adventuring.
9 episodes is too short, I think. I think a lot of us video game fans are finally realizing what it's like to have one of your favorite books adapted. I saw this comparison maybe on the Reddit or maybe someone else said it. So it's not an original thought. Like, very few of my thoughts, to be honest.
He's too harsh on himself. too harsh on himself over there.
But I think it's very apt because, you know, you adapt a book, like The Lord of the Rings, for instance. And if you're a huge fan of those books, you get to spend way more time with those characters and see their inner workings more than you do in a television show or especially a movie. And I think that's what we're experiencing with The Last of Us.
Totally.
You know, The Last of Us is characters, and the relationship between Ellie and Joel is so defined by the kind of moment-to-moment gameplay where a lot of story isn't happening, where you're just kind of searching around, you're kind of having sometimes optional conversations, you're just getting familiar with their presence, and a show with only 9 episodes just can't replicate that. Mm. So it feels fast. It feels like the pace is up. And I think the show itself has issues with that. I think even if you haven't played the game, you might still think it's a little bit fast. But yep. I think it's a similar thing to a book adaptation where you're so used to spending so much time with the characters that anything less feels like they're just absolutely ripping through it with pace.
I would totally back that. I think, yeah, the change in medium does mean like a real crunch of length of time, just like literal exposure of character writing and where they have to kind of pick and choose specific scenes to get across. Yeah, I mean, I've been pretty vocal about, like, I really hated the first episode. I've not been a fan of most of it. I love the Bill and Frank episode and the Ellie Riley episodes. Mm-hmm. They both had me in absolute bits and it made me realize that I would have loved if they just didn't do the Joel Ellie story at all. And I know obviously Ellie Riley is directly from The Left Behind, but I just feel like that was just nicely fleshed out and acted so beautifully. I love Bella Ramsey's performance in that whole thing. Every little facial animation. We were talking before about the pre-drink romance.
Yeah.
She got that sort of like teenage, like, does that person like me? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
The unsureness of it was just beautifully done. But yeah, overall, I've not really enjoyed the season, but I'm super vocal about the fact that I am just one of those precious a-holes when it comes to the original source material. I just think that is just so vastly superior that nothing was ever going to come close to it for the most part. So it's only really been a handful of scenes that I've liked, but when I watch most episodes, I do find that I'm like, okay, that was a bit better. Oh my God, I hate that. Okay, that was better. Okay, that was rushed. That sucks. So for me, it's nowhere. Yeah, I guess I would say it's overrated personally, but like, I get why it's rated highly.
Yeah.
I get why people like it. I just personally, it's hardly any of it is for me.
Yeah, I totally get why people might not like it. I think it's like too slow or it doesn't have, like, not exactly what they wanted or, you know, it's not quite living up to the incredible hype that I got before. Like, for me, it's a great show. It's not one of my favorite shows. You know what I mean? I love the show, and I think more or less every episode is pretty much flawless, but I agree that it's not as good as the source material. The source material is a little bit better. Though the show has made some changes that is better than the
there
source
are, yeah,
material.
Yeah, there are bits and pieces that are cool.
Is a holistic thing. It's just, for me, it is a really good show. Mm-hmm. Whether it's going to end up in my top 10 list of all time, I don't know. I don't think it's as good as something as, you know, Better Call Saul or,
well, that's the thing, right?
Mad Men or like The Americans or something like that. But it's still, that doesn't mean it's bad or it doesn't mean it's even like not living up to its potential because it's still getting most things right.
No, totally. I think we're talking about like gradients of like a 4.5 to 5-star mark and like what differentiates those two things. That's the thing for me, like the amount of praise that it's getting, I do think is kind of crazy considering what's really there. Like, yeah, I mean, it's not to make it about the show, but like for me, if those are the comparisons, the Better Call Sauls, for me, Severance is one of my favorite shows I've ever seen. That came out last year. Those are just like so beautifully made and paced and like they're so purposeful and they have so much to say. And like, it's just, I'm not getting any of that from The Last of Us. And that might just be because I literally cannot divorce the source material. But I guess it's one of those things where I think the story just didn't have as much, doesn't have as much to it in the TV version. But this is a conversation for the rest of time.
It
because
is.
There'll always be my side and there'll always be your side.
It's a bit difficult for me to kind of contextualize it as well because I never watch shows week to week, certainly not from when they start. I like a show to have an ending and I like this view.
I thought about your rule.
Yeah, I like to view it like holistically as like a full package because, you know, I don't think I've ever watched a first season of a show, any show, and gone, that's one of my favorite shows of all time.
Right.
If I watched Better Call Saul season one, I wouldn't be saying that's in my top 10, in my top 5. Same with The Americans, same with Mad Men or whatever. I'd be saying those are really good shows, but I kind of need to wait until this. I need to keep reminding myself that I need to wait until this one is complete before I can make those decisions because it's just not how I personally operate. Some of the people might be different, but for me personally, it's just I've always waited until something's finished before I can decide, okay, now I can see it in totality, and this is what I think as a whole.
No.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're definitely right that a lot of shows do build. I think things like Breaking Bad, like season one was always brilliant. Like Severance, I'd still point out to Severance, that only has one season, but I feel like it's so confident the whole way through. Succession is like really solid as well. But yeah, I think it's interesting that the general conversation. Last of Us, like just to be completely honest about it, we did a whole bunch of episode by episode reviews and the views just weren't there for it. Like it's such a massive show and you see headlines about how much it's breaking all these numbers, but I don't really feel like there is that much conversation around it happening. It's kind of just there. It's almost like a Minecraft or a Fortnite. Like, you're fully aware that it's there. It's almost bigger than any one coverage outlet can do. And maybe the more TV-based websites are doing their fan theories and stuff. I know that they are out there, but the general sort of like conversation around it, when you compare it to a Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon, like an HBO show, maybe it's an algorithmic presentation of data thing, but I feel like that general depth isn't there for the coverage.
That is hilarious. This is what makes me think it's an algorithmic thing, perhaps, because this is the most I've seen anyone talk about a show since Game of Thrones, which is amazing. I've seen more people talk about this than like House of the Dragon, but that might be just like the circles that I'm clued into. Like, it's the first time in forever, literally since like The Walking Dead season 5, probably, or maybe the final season of Game of Thrones, where I've not been able to look at social media because I know I'm going to get a spoiler. In that, I've never
get anything.
Well, this is it, right? Like, it's probably because I'm just clicking this stuff, so show me this stuff, but I think we just live in algorithmic bubbles these days.
We kind of do. I feel like you can never tell
objectively, I don't think.
Well, that's the thing. I think with this, like, obviously when an episode's out, there'll be occasional. So there's a lot of Pedro Pascal love. I see a lot of him doing the rods. But yeah, I feel like overall it is interesting just the sheer heights the show's been able to hit, the critical response it's getting. The audience viewing numbers are unbelievable. Like, it is breaking records in terms of it gained like 2 more million viewers or something between episodes, which apparently is really rare for a whole season. Usually they drop off as the season goes on. So all that stuff is just super commendable. But I just, for me, I guess because I personally don't love it, that I'm just like, I'm not seeing that stuff. Whatever parts of my phone are listening to my everyday speech are not saving me things up. So there is that. But we'll see how the rest of the season plays out. I thought the Riley Ellie episode made the rest of it way better. So there is that holistic view feel to it as well. And I guess we'll see what happens in the next two. Question from PG Quips, who says, what are your Oscar predictions this year? I think Everything Everywhere All at Once deserves best film. How can anyone possibly challenge Hot Dog Fingers? Also, how does The Big Light now feel? Does it feel oppressive? we're burying the Big Light discourse. I have buried the Big Light myself. I bought a bunch of ambient lights. I no longer game or watch TV or watch anything with a Big Light on. Big Light is dead to me.
Praise the Lord. We are holding a ceremony for the Big Light next week. All of you are invited to come pay your respects to the Big Light.
The light in my life is a purple bar, and it goes behind my TV, and that's it.
The biggest irony, I think, of this entire Big Light chat is that when I got my PSVR, the first thing it said was, turn on your big lights, because this thing needs a light to, you know, actually function.
Right.
And I thought, I can't believe I've been swindled by the thing that I was looking forward to the most into indulging in the Big Light lifestyle. But yeah, let's bury it. It's no more ambient light for the win. Scott Tailford has seen the light, I reckon.
He's seen the rotating app-based smart bulb light, which lets him have a different color for whatever he's watching. But I'd be completely honest, I have dropped the F off films.
Right.
It sounds so stupid when I kept up with film for so long. And I'm overall a huge fan of the medium and can have all these conversations about film and grew up watching films, everything. Over the years, but very recently, nothing is making me care about film. I was looking forward to The Whale, and then when it finally released, I was like, I can't be bothered to have a full day in work and then go see a movie. So I just haven't done it, and I don't know if that is per film, but I also made a big, I looked at the release calendar for the rest of the year, and I drew up a big list of everything that was remotely on my radar.
Yeah.
And it's just old sequels and stuff that I know what it's going to be.
Right.
And it just has that core thing of me going like, well, that doesn't excite me. I don't care about Marvel anymore. I'm checked out of all the big business stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, Creed 3's out. And I'm like, well, I love Michael B. Jordan. I want to see that because it's his first directing role. And I love, I want to see what Jonathan Majors can do. But that's kind of it. Like, I'm just films as a thing. I'm so checked out.
Not for you anymore. That's kinda, interesting.
It's sad because I do love them and I want to love them more. And I need to put more effort into seeking out indies and stuff. It's not like I'm not watching anything.
Yeah.
But they're just so few and far between at the minute.
I'm trying my best because the pandemic kind of like killed my interest in movies dead for whatever reason. I used to watch hundreds of films a year and then suddenly in the pandemic, because I wasn't going to the cinema, perhaps I was just like not seeing.
That's definitely
much.
My thing. The pandemic stopped me going to the cinema, and I just, for whatever reason, I dropped off Letterboxd. I'm not updating that. Like, I'm not keeping up with movies. I'm just not doing it.
Me too, man. Mm. And I'm trying to make a concerted effort because it's not that there's not stuff coming out that I want to see. There is actually too much coming out that I want to see, and it's frustrating because there are so many movies out, and I'm like, I should go and see that. And you get home after work, and you're a little bit too tired, and you think, oh, maybe next week, and the movie's not showing anymore, and then something else is coming out, and you think, maybe I should see that after work, and then you're too tired and then you don't go to see it. That said, though, I think it's an incredible year for the old Academy Awards.
Okay.
I've seen almost all of the Best Picture nominees with the exception of Avatar, The Way of Water.
Can you reel off the current Best Picture nomination?
I certainly can, Scott Tilford. We have All Quiet on the Western Front, Avatar, The Way of Water, The Banshees of Inisherin, Elvis, Everything Everywhere All at Once, which was said in the tweet. The Fablemans, Tar, Top Gun Maverick, Triangle of Sadness, and Women Talking.
Oh, I'll tell you another thing. One of the reasons that it puts me, that I'm just in this weird space where I feel like I can't even access the films I want to see. I feel like because of the weird staggered release dates, you see something coming out. Women Talking, I've wanted to see for what, like 3 months?
Right.
Like, I'm sure that was out in America last year.
Yes.
And then we've just been waiting for it over here. And it's like, okay, where is it? How do I see this? And then sometimes things will just appear on Disney Plus because Disney Plus in the UK do various deals with like HBO or whatever and just dump stuff on there.
Yeah.
Different Fox movies and stuff. Smile was just randomly on Disney Plus. would never associate that with a Disney thing whatsoever. So that throws me off. I don't know where to go to watch the films anymore. I think that's part of it. But yeah, part of that, I did not know Top Gun Maverick was up for Best Picture.
Yeah, man.
That's hilarious.
Like, that and Avatar are, like, obviously huge commercial successes from last year that have been kind of honored here. I think it's a really good lineup. For me, I kind of do see Everything Everywhere All at Once winning.
I hope so.
I don't hope so.
What? Why?
I just think there's so many other better movies. So many other better, that's not really a good phrase. Better movies on that list than that. For me, I want to see Banshees of Inisherin win. I love that. Seen that movie twice. Think it's great.
Okay.
I think
I've only seen three of them. I've seen Everything Everywhere, Top Gun Maverick, and Banshees of Inisherin. I really want to see Tar, but I haven't seen that yet.
Nice, nice. And I just want to shout out one more before we go, because Paul Mescal for Aftersun is up for Best Actor. And Aftersun is like one of my favorite movie of like the last decade.
I still need to see that.
And I don't think he'll win, but I want him to win, you know what I mean?
The praise that you and Nicholas had when you guys, the day after you'd seen it or something, I was like, I need to immediately see this.
Yeah.
And I think it was on at one of the cinemas near us, but I was like, it sounds really sad.
It's very sad.
And I find it really hard to volunteer for a sad thing now. I used to do it a lot more before the pandemic, but I don't know, in the current space, I'm not like spending my evening volunteering for sadness. I find I'll go watch some anime or something, where someone will fly through the sky with some powers. I'll do that instead. But I do want to see Aftersun. I feel like that's a general and a really good recommendation based on the reception so far.
I wish that was up for Best Picture. That would get my vote 100%. But you like Everything Everywhere All at Once.
I love that
movie.
Do you
want to talk about that merits? Because you liked it more than me, and you seem to be in line with the tweet.
Yes.
So... would you like to see it win? Sorry.
I would. Like I said, I'm not invested whatsoever in it. I think it'd be hilarious if Top Gun Maverick wins. I feel like all the Best Picture stuff over the years, it's such a nebulous thing to drill down, because didn't The Revenant eventually win it? Or DiCaprio won Best Actor?
He did for The Revenant.
For The Revenant, because he ate some steak that was raw and whatever. Like, it's just like that idea of, like, okay, what makes it the best performance? What makes it the best picture? And is that like an overall ambitious scale thing? Because I do think Daniels are like an incredible directorial combo. I think there's two of them.
Yeah.
Yes. For Everything Everywhere. And I think the amount of stuff they achieved with that for me was what Multiverse of Madness should have been. By far. And just the sheer inventiveness of what they did. I kind of wanted a little bit more, maybe do some more animated universes or something. But when they have a universe that is just a couple of rocks with googly eyes talking to each other and it all just fades away to just text on the screen. There's a lot of stuff that I loved in that movie. And I think that it has a beautiful like heart to it as well. It does have a message. It does have something to take away and realize like the different ways that you chart your own life and how do you find satisfaction. And I think it has a lot of heart to it. And,
it did.
I think it's almost impossible to have something with that much heart be in a movie of that much scale.
Yes.
When there's so much wacky hot dog finger BS stuff going on, you can still bring it back down to the person and make it about that person.
Yeah.
I think that movie was beautiful, but I don't have the wider pool. Like Banshees of Inisherin, I thought was cool, but I thought it way outstayed its welcome.
Really?
By about like 45 minutes or something. I was like, I get this. You've made your point. Oh, it's just the same point again. Okay, cool.
To me, that was kind of Everything Everywhere, to be honest. Probably, was another one where, if it sounds like a crap, I got Everything Everywhere. I thought it was a really good movie, like a really nice crowd pleaser, made me emotional towards the end. It was just, it was a film where the wackiest stuff didn't do it for me, which is a shame because I've liked other stuff that the Daniels have done. Just like the first half where we're talking about, like, we're getting into like the world building and the sci-fi
the
of
rules.
It. The rules. That stuff paled in comparison to the latter half where it was more emotionally driven. It was just, I genuinely wasn't interested in the first half and then it pulled me around for the second half. I just think it's an ambitious movie and it should be applauded. It just didn't quite come together for me in a way that it seems to have for like so many other people. And I wouldn't hate that if it won. It's not like an undeserving winner, I don't think. There's just, for me personally, other movies on that list that I liked a little bit more and hit me a little bit more.
I do think for like a Best Picture category, what I was trying to get at before is like there's almost an assumed level of like weight or narrative depth, or like there's just a certain feel to a movie that gets Best Picture, and I maybe don't have as much of a working knowledge of the like of all of the Best Picture nominees and of the last like 20 odd years to say like, okay, well that actually won it and that was like more zany or whatever. But I feel like something like Tar or Banshees of Inisherin has the pacing to it that feels more like a Best Picture candidate. Even something like Aftersun, from what I've seen of it, would feel more like a Best Picture candidate. And so it'd be a miracle if something Top Gun Maverick doesn't feel like it could get Best Picture.
But it's cool to see it there. It's kind of like when Mad Max Fury Road was in the nomination list and you just got like a really good weighty blockbuster with like a big story heft and doing something that's doing something ambitious and it's cool to see them there. Like, it's cool to see Avatar there. I haven't even seen it, but I like that that's, like, in the list. I think it's quite nice.
I was with an entire room of people at a wedding recently, and I asked if anyone had seen Avatar, and one person had.
Right.
So I finally found one person who's seen Avatar. I still maintain that no one's seen Avatar, but it's just, like, I don't know anyone who's seen Way of Water apart from this one random person. But still, I've seen it two billion times. Probably, yeah, trying to make up all the shortfall. I need to catch up with that film. But I just don't care. Does anyone care? Avatar? I don't think so. Question from Jack Asbury, who says, what's your most biased opinion on the Activision acquisition?
Oh, this is where I show myself as a fraud and a hypocrite. I think my most biased. Okay. Here's the thing. On an intellectual level,
okay,
I know the acquisition is bad.
Yes.
I don't want, in theory, monopolies to exist.
Okay,
in for some one company to hold so much power. I don't like that Disney bought Fox. And the fact that Microsoft is buying Activision alongside all these other studios scares me, because I don't want it to become homogenized in such a way that there's no competition, because when someone doesn't have any competition, they have no incentive to try. And you'll get over that period where it's exciting and when they are trying to push the button to the point where they become complacent because they have no one really vying for their crown. Mm-hmm. And then they just start serving you a load of duff, kind of like how Disney is right now with a bunch of their movies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it's Activision, and Activision sucks, and you hope, and I don't want Activision to even continue as they are right now, because that company is a trash fire, creatively and seemingly behind the scenes, if the report is to be believed. So it's a case of, if my most biased opinion is, Microsoft is probably going to do good things to that company, at least in the short term, or you would hope, and could ultimately salvage it in a way. That's where my kind of hypocritical two takes like come out, because if there is a company that needs saving, it's Activision, followed by like Ubisoft. Like, those ships need writing, and it would be better for the entire gaming industry and presumably the people working for those companies if those ships were steered right. It's just, it sucks that to get that kind of correctedness, you need to kind of indulge in a monopolistic way of viewing the world.
My completely biased take is that I've been nothing but disappointed by Xbox for 10 years now.
Right.
I think that it was such an alarm bell when Halo Infinite was 2 months from launch, and then they showed it off and it was completely broken, and then it was delayed a year, where I was just like, what the hell are you doing? Like, I don't, like, the whole thing with Phil Spencer, like, as much as I guess that whole thing, I believe in Phil Spencer, and he's almost become a bit of a meme, and like, because he seems like a cool dude. Like, the guy sits down, does lots of really good personable interviews, dude plays a lot of games, seems to know his stuff. But now all the stuff, his comments on exclusivity either he lied in the first place, or he's changed his opinion very severely, going from saying that exclusives are bad for the industry to then saying exclusives are part of the industry.
Yeah.
It's like, well, which one is it? Which one are you doing? Does that depend on what your business deal is of the given month? I think that's just really annoying. And I think coming up as a 360 fan and then looking at where Xbox are now, and I just find it so boring. Like, can they just make a game? Like, how hard is it? Like, we got Hi-Fi Rush, which was already in production before Tango Gameworks got bought out. So they kind of laid claim to that. And obviously we ended up covering it as like, oh, Xbox did right by shadow dropping it and whatever, which they did. They helped facilitate the launch of it. But where are the games?
Where are the games?
What are you doing? Like, I can't believe that it's so many years in that we wasted an entire Xbox One generation, and now we're into the next thing, but we have one of the most powerful systems on the market, if not the most powerful system. And one, you can't make games for it because you have to make them for the Series S as well. And two, what games are even coming? There was a recent report, it was a podcast where Andy Robinson from Video Game Chronicle was talking about the games that are coming soon, and it's like Starfield and Avowed. But Fable only just went into full production. Perfect Dark is in like quadruple A development hell. The next game from Rare is like years away.
Yeah.
I'm like, how? How are you getting this so wrong? And so like, for me to fall back on like, well, we just have a lot of money, so I guess we'll just buy our first party slate.
Yeah.
I hate that. I really hate that. Like, I just think that's so soulless. Like, and you used to not used to stand for anything, but like Xbox 360 used to have pillars, like used to have Gears of War and Fable, and like Halo used to be in a much better state. And I just hate that the reality of where Xbox is now is we've got some money, we're kind of like a trust fund kid, and we'll just buy stuff.
Yeah,
and that's what we do, and then we'll sort of just pretend that these are our first party games when they never were.
I think they've got a lot of goodwill. For me, personally, in buying studios that kind of felt like they were quote unquote in need. When they bought Obsidian, for instance, I love Obsidian Games, but we've talked so many times about how that studio was treated poorly by publishers in the past. You know what I mean? Given insane turnarounds for projects like Knights of the Old Republic 2 and Fallout New Vegas, not appreciated as they should be. So when they buy a studio like that, you think, finally, they'll be appreciated. They'll have the resources that they need to make good games. And it's the same with Activision. It's like, you know, oh, finally, someone can hopefully right the Activision ship, make more use of their IP, make the working conditions better, hopefully try to salvage whatever the hell's going on with Blizzard and their absolute nightmare of an entire decade. But it's all in theory. It's all just kind of like on paper, this could be a good thing. But like you were saying there, in reality, we've kind of not even seen how Microsoft is. Are they treating these teams any better? Like, are they creatively supported? We haven't seen any games that kind of signify that yet because they're all in this kind of weird planning stage. So my biased thing is that it all sounds good in theory, but when I think about it and when you talk about it like that, Scott, it's like, yeah, in reality, is it going to be better? We haven't seen the proof in the pudding yet.
No, my thing is like, if you can let 3-4 industries, if you can let Halo fall as far as it has, if I mean, Halo is, let's just be pretty honest, it's almost dead. I know it's just got a new season of content, but who's excited for that? Who's really playing it? Most of the Halo fan base, and I'm one of them, are playing it just to see if it's remotely better at this point. It's never like an actual confident, fulfilling content drop. It's just something better than the bare minimum you had before. And it's just like, if they can let that fall so far and let 343 go so far off the rails, like for so long as well, then I don't really believe they would get hands-on invested with Activision and the creative direction of Activision. I think they buy them just to bolster Game Pass and just to say, look, because I just feel like it's exactly what Phil Spencer said years ago about like planning for the future and that they want to compete with Amazon and Google rather than Sony and Nintendo because they're just planning for the Xbox app to be on every TV next to a Netflix or whatever. They just want, you know, Xbox streaming to be everywhere. And that's a viable business plan, but I find nothing more boring than a games company that doesn't make games. So I just look at that going like, okay, sure. Like you moved some chess pieces around and you made some money for your grandkids, apparently. Like it's nothing to me.
Especially when that games company owns so many great game makers. Yeah. Like when you're not seeing the product come out, that's when it gets like incredibly frustrating because you hope that when the product arrives, it's going to be worthwhile. But we've been saying for about, 4 or 5 years now? The product's coming. It's on its way. These games are going to come out this year. And then they never do.
It was like Fable, the reboot was announced, I think it was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Nothing. Nothing at all. Just a logo. And then now it's in full production.
Perfect Dark, a quadruple A game, is it? And that sounds like it's going really well.
It's just annoying. And I think if you don't have the comparison for how firing on all cylinders they were in the 2000s. And the thing is, Xbox themselves have put out that, there's a really good, I can't even think of the name of it now, but it's on their main Xbox channel, the history of the last 20 years. Of Xbox. That's a really good deep dive into their own history, and they don't shy away from the mistakes they made in the Xbox One period. But if you look at the staff that were around at the beginning, and you look at the way that everything charted over time, and just the difference in what they prioritize, and it makes sense to try and bulk out Game Pass and bulk out streaming. It is to some degree the future of gaming. Obviously, we're still in flux with that, but like it's just a different approach to gaming, and we wouldn't have the modern industry without things like Xbox Live, you know, if they didn't push for those. So they are pushing for worthwhile things, but they used to be able to do that with the games as well.
Yeah,
and I just like a giant business decision going through that doesn't really do anything. It's not like, oh my god, we've got this great idea that we can only like put together if we combine the talents of 343 with some dude from Activision. Like, we're not doing that. We're just talking about putting titles on Game Pass. Like, that's kind of all this is. So yeah, that's definitely my most personal bias ranty side of it, is that I'm largely annoyed with Xbox and pissed at the state of it after having grown up with a way better company for the better part of 20 years.
It's kind of a good point, right? Because I don't think this justifies, you know, buying a company as big as Fox. But for instance, when Disney bought Fox, you still had like, you would at the very least had possibilities of what that company could now do. Like, again, I'm not saying it justifies it, but at least you had the thought of, oh, that means the MCU can use the Fox characters. And they've gotten the license to the X-Men and the Fantastic Four. There was like a potential possibility there.
Mm-hmm.
I've never thought about it in this way, but like you were saying just then, you know, when Microsoft buys all of these studios and makes these acquisitions, what possibilities are you thinking? You're thinking this might make for better games, but you're not viewing it in terms of necessarily how can Microsoft make these games better?
They don't even care.
No, that's it, right? I can from an Activision point of view, perhaps by, you know, maybe they'll revitalize old IP. Maybe they'll take Call of Duty off an annualized process. But, you know, something like The Outer Worlds 2, you know, it's kind of like, would Obsidian have made that anyway? And how much benefit is Microsoft even getting from that? How much are they adding to it? Because like you said there, in the case of 343 or in the case of what sounds like Fable and Perfect Dark, they don't even have this hands-on approach anyway. Is it just a supply of money and time that they're pumping in, which is shouldn't be taken for granted, especially in the video game world? But I'm thinking on that kind of like bigger picture sense, like what are you adding to these studios that isn't just time and money, or is just time and money the main thing that matters?
Well, that's kind of the thing. I think that they just, like, you know, they got Double Fine and they were able to, I mean, Psychonauts 2 was long in production at that point, but they were able to get that over the finish line with whatever help they got from Xbox at the final stages of development. Obsidian are the one best example of this so far, because they got to do the dream thing of make smaller games whilst your bigger game is in production, like Pentiment, and, you know, manage Grounded as well, which is obviously like a nice little fan favorite game, cult classic kind of thing at the minute. And they do have bigger games like Avowed coming in the future. They are almost the template for what that whole model could be. It's just that it's taken almost, well, one, like, it's taken a console generation and we're into the second year of the newest systems, and you still don't have anything where you can say buy a Series X to play blah. You don't have that game yet. And I just think that maybe that's old school thinking. Maybe it is in the business meetings that the likes of Phil Spencer are in, where it's just not about the games. It's about the service and it's about the future and it's about building out the portfolio. Because in 20, 30, 50 years time, Xbox is an app available on your brain chip in VR or whatever, because that's just what they're planning for. And maybe as a overall head of Xbox, that's what he needs to think of. He can't think small. So he's not even concerned that Halo is bombing, because it's not even on his radar.
Yeah.
He's thinking about, like, what are the business deals? Like that whole thing of when all the stuff was happening with Bobby Kotick 2 years ago, where he was potentially going to be ousted from the company, that was apparently when Phil Spencer put the business deal together to swoop in and snatch everybody up. The fact that it was that fast and the fact that it was that impulsive, it kind of speaks to the kind of deals he wants to make, as opposed to swooping in and snatching up Hideo Kojima or whatever when he was like, or getting Ken Levine, making sure that Judas is platform exclusive or something like that. I'm just a big care of creative output, and I just don't care about business deals. Like,
you're
unless
right,
they facilitate the creative output. So we'll see what comes out of it, but. Or a rant for the in the morning on a Friday.
Love it. I love it, man.
Next question from Jarvis. Also, massive shout out to Jarvis Sensei, one of the people who are helping put together Republic of Jungle. Me and Jules did a stage demo for that last year.
Yes, you certainly
did. Just to quickly mention that. She says, oi, oi, with AAA gaming seemingly taking over TV with Cyberpunk, Edgerunners, The Last of Us, and Arcane, plus Horizon Zero Dawn and God of War shows on the way, which indie title do you think would most suit a TV adaptation?
Oh, what a question.
I know.
I didn't expect that swerve to come right at the end.
My mind goes immediately to Sifu.
I would take
a lovely Sifu martial arts show.
Oh, I would take that.
Oh.
Go on.
Oh.
Let's make that happen now. Get me the Sifu show straight away.
I'll tell you
every
what,
episode going
super quickly.
Yeah.
Super hot quickly. They did do a live action Sifu advert that is extremely well choreographed.
Did they?
Yeah. It was, I think it was back when the game first came out. It's on Sony's, well, it'll be on one of the YouTube channels. If you search Sifu live action cinematic, there is a very good mini Sifu movie already existing.
I love that. I know. I don't know what I would pick, to be honest. Sifu's a great shout.
Thank you.
I'm trying to think of, when I think of, you know, stuff that I want translated to like a television show or a movie or whatever, adapted in that way, I don't think of indies, because I think of indies as being so gameplay focused.
Yeah.
That I think they work oftentimes better as like just a game. Mm-hmm. But I think the exception to that would be some horror titles. I would love to see, you know, Visage adapted. I would love to see Madison adapted. And I know Blumhouse Studios has said that they're going to be making more video game horror movies and making more horror video games based on their own properties. Mm. So I think that might be a good outlet for that. But I would probably go the horror route for this and say something like Madison.
Could you do a Signalis anime?
Oh, yeah, you could.
Or a stop-motion Vanishing of Ethan Carter. Or what's the one when you go to that big house and it's like the whole family's been living in the house and
What Remains of Edith Finch?
Yes, stop motion What Remains of Edith Finch. Make it like Tim Burton style.
The thing is, right, you could do it, but is the pleasure of a game like that not in the active storytelling of you as a participant and being able to play as like a a fish that rolls down or a shark or whatever it is, you know?
A giant octopus tendril. I feel like the What Remains of Edith Finch has so many creative ideas for that family. I feel like there's so many, like, such a great art direction to that house and, like, the feeling of it and then the overall message by the time you get to the end of it, that you do need some reveals to happen, like, to the player. But I feel like that world... I'm just thinking through the lens of, like, your Corpse Brides I can't think of the dude that did Secret of Kells now, but that art style, I feel like you could kind of do a really cool animated approach.
Got one for you.
Do it.
Hollow Knight. The same animated style. And do like that's Hollow Knight has such a rich world and like such interesting characters that you come across. I think you could extrapolate that into a really cool animated show. I'd like to see that. I probably wouldn't watch it. I'd say I want it and then never watch it. But I like the idea that could exist.
The thing is with Hollow Knight, he can't talk, so you'd have to do like maybe 5-10 minute little chunks.
No, but
go on.
In the new one, Hollow Knight Silk Song,
yes,
that's a character from the original who, if I'm remembering correctly, did talk. So you don't necessarily have to have the little Hollow Knight himself. You could have make it about. You could make like spin-off. You could like set it just within that world with some of the characters turning up in a new central character. Mm-hmm. Something like that, perhaps.
There was a joke right there about spinning silk and you saying spin-off. I didn't take it. But I will take the next question from Stefan Moore, who says, what are your favorite photo modes in games and what game doesn't have one that you wish did? Ooh. Mine is The Evil Within 2.
Oh, The Evil Within 2. Yes, you'll love to see it. Scott, you're a big photos man.
Oh my
God, general.
I spend more time in photo modes than games themselves.
Tell me which one you like the most.
A Ghost of Tsushima. I love any... It's very, very rare that a game will let you pause, go into photo mode, place your camera, and then have some way of advancing frame by frame whatever was about to happen after you freeze time.
Yeah.
So I love starting an animation, starting a sword swing, a kick, or whatever you want, and then just playing it out frame by frame and just drinking in that animation fidelity. It's one of my favorite things in games to do. And I love that in Ghost of Tsushima, you can change all the weather effects. You can really have fun with the different filters that are in there, which filters are your standard things to put in. But games like... Even Gotham Knights that let you change the weather, let you change like just everything about the ambiance of the whole scene setup, as well as Gotham Knights sadly doesn't let you do the frame by frame thing, but Tsushima does, and I just love animation fidelity. Give me slow motion modes, give me all that stuff whilst I can move the camera and take photos.
I'm not really a huge photo mode fan, or at least I wasn't in a lot of games until Sony kind of started doing it. And there was something just about the look of their games and the implementation of their photo modes that really kind of got me in it. And Ghost of Tsushima was absolutely one of those for me. But instead of repeating that, the first one that I really got obsessed with was Spider-Man 2018, Insomniac's Spider-Man game.
Okay.
Because the filters you could throw on, like the different poses you could get Spider-Man himself.
Poses are a huge one too.
Yep. The backdrops, you could set your photo against, you know, like the cool comic book vignettes that you could put on there. As a big Spider-Man fan, that was kind of like a real dream come true, especially when you throw in the different costumes you could put Spider-Man himself in to keep the variation up. There was something about Spider-Man's photo mode where I just thought it made me feel like a kid again.
No, dude, honestly, Spider-Man's a great shout. Marvel's Midnight Suns, right up there with Tsushima, that has the same stuff that Spidey does, where you can make your own comic book covers, but the amount of options you have, and also you can take shots like in-game and then make them comic book covers, and the amount of options they give you for putting just lots of, like, Marvel's Midnight Suns will go on to be the most overlooked Marvel game ever because they really cared about the Marvel-ness of it. And when you're making your front covers, you can pick the corner price icon, and you can pick like all the different publishing logos to make it look like it was like a first issue of something. You can add like all these different effects to it, all these different sound effects like blam and splat and whatever else. And it just looks great. And I think Midnight Suns took what Spidey did and just sort of did the wider version of it for way more characters and stuff.
I need to play this game.
Oh my God, dude. I almost bought the DLC. I love Midnight Suns like so much. I get why people bounce off these sort of like the uwu style. I don't even know what that term means, but I keep hearing it as a general cutesy term. But that sort of approach to the way that you would do the hub world stuff, because it's a lot of like, everyone's my friend and everything's great and let's do like pizza parties and whatever. And I think that there's a way that you can just enjoy that. I loved it. Like, I think it really works. But the combat is where it's at.
Yeah.
And the heart of that game is where it's at. The story's fun enough, but they do really cool things with the character dialogue, and they do really cool things with things like the photo mode, where they just cared about you living in a giant X-Mansion style space with all your favorite heroes, and everyone loves everyone, and it just works.
I love that.
And Blade has a book club.
Yes!
And you can hang out
does.
Doing Blade's book club. I want to end the podcast shouting out, we got sent this from You Done Messed Up Aaron, who just said there's a charity game bundle raising money for the earthquake relief in Turkey and Syria over on, this is written up by PC Gamer, but it's like 69 games for about $30. It's £25. So I just wanted to shout that out. There's obviously a whole bunch of relief efforts going towards that. And the bundle includes things like XCOM 2 and Armello, which is a really cool tactics game. Read through it when I first read up, woke up this morning and flicked through some things. But yeah, go check that bundle out. I guess you'll be able to find it if you search the $30 Turkey Syria relief bundle. Hopefully it'll guide you in the right direction. Anything we can do to help that, we will do. For now though, this has been the Untitled Banter podcast, the UPP, the UPP,
UPP, the UPP,
the UPP. I've been Scott Tilford, that's been Josh Brown. Massive thank you to Josh Brown.
Thank you for having me on, Scott. I love it, and I always end these podcasts worried I've made a fool of myself, but hopefully I've not.
He could not be in any better human in my life. For now though, we'll catch you next time.
See you later.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.